Okay, let's quickly look at what is included in brackets in most of your Bibles, I suppose, if you've got an ESV or the American Standard or what have you. Some may not even include the text, but or put it at the end. There's various theories about this, about the fact that maybe it belongs in Luke somewhere, or maybe even at the end of this gospel. But I have a statement up there from the textual commentary on the Greek New Testament. The evidence for the non-Johannine origin of this section is overwhelming. And then I've got a bunch of other stuff, just in case anybody argues with me. I'm kind of prepared. But people are a lot smarter than me. But the point is, and I think this one sums it up pretty well, it's absent from virtually all early Greek manuscripts and from very many of the other language groups. None of the early church fathers who wrote commentaries on John's gospel include this. There can be no real doubt that it was not an original part of John. One or two manuscripts include it in Luke after 21:38. This may be a clue to its origin, as the passage has some textual affinities with the language of Luke's gospel. These are all the stuff I read on from very, very conservative scholars, and so I'm not reading from any of the more liberal guys. In any case, there is some feeling that this story about the woman caught in adultery is a real story. They just don't believe that it belongs in the Greek text. So that's the idea. So, but let's go ahead and read it, and then we'll start with, we'll kind of make a couple of comments and go from there. Someone want to read? In my Bible, it starts at verse 53, which they put down with the next section. So that'd be verse 53 through 8:11. So I'm going to read that for us. Go ahead, Jim.
They went each to his own house, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. So what do you say?" This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." And once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the older ones. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" And she said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on sin no more."
Okay. Let's assume for a minute that, let's assume at least that this is something that actually happened, that got recorded into some of the manuscripts, later manuscripts, 6th century, I think it's the first time it appears. But assuming that, certainly this is a famous story. I mean, what do we say? What from this do we commonly say?
Go and sin no more.
Okay, well, that, yeah.
He is not judge.
He who is out without sin.
Cast the first stone. Yeah, you know, that's kind of a saying that's gotten some traction in our world. What do you think Jesus is saying? Let's just get kind of the gist of this. What do you think is the point of this story? That we shouldn't call out adulterers? Is that it? Or what? Aaron?
Well, they say, in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women.
Okay.
And I think maybe it's something to say about just the legalism of how they were acting, was they were focusing on some things and they themselves breaking the law on other things.
Okay. Right. Amy.
And then there's clearly a degree of hypocrisy there. If she's caught in adultery, then there's clearly two people involved. And where's the man? You've probably heard Rich say this, but he was teeing for a professor who did like the history of Jesus, historical Jesus. And so like one theory, it's obviously just a theory, is that what Jesus is writing on the ground is, where is the man?
Oh, where's the man? Now, where's the beef? Where's the man? Yeah. Okay. I think that's important. What would you, Anything else, Brady?
I think there's an accusation of the sin from the people. There's a confirmation of the sin from Jesus when he says sin no more. There's a condemnation of the sin which comes from the law. And then there's a salvation of the sin which comes through Jesus. And it reminds me of 3:17, for God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved from him.
Yeah, good. Yeah, good connection there with that. That's good. Heather, you?
He pretty much said, he said much better what I was thinking.
Okay. Well, we could see. We could be the judge of that.
That was the direction I was going.
Okay. How about verse 6? Does that play into this? Mm-hmm. Yeah. They said this to test him. See, I think this, just to kind of run to the end here, I think this is all about testing Jesus. And I think she probably committed adultery. If the story's true, I think she committed adultery, but I think they set it all up and in order to test Jesus, and that's why the man's not around. And that's why Jesus said, you who have sinned. I think he's saying, you all committed adultery, so you can't cast stone. If that's what he's saying at all. What he's saying is, you're complicit in this setup, and you know it. And of course, they put the stones down. They didn't end up stoning her after all. If they were going to keep the law, they would have thrown the stones at Jesus and then stoned her. So,
do you know if they could have done that? I mean, I guess because maybe this is why they just brought the woman too. But since they're under Roman occupation, like, can they perform executions? Like, are they allowed to?
Well, they did with
they
Stephen.
They get in trouble?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my guess not. I don't think the Romans cared who got killed. They were pretty...
Yeah, right. I mean, one less Jewish, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they stoned Stephen, and, you know, right. In Acts. Yeah, I don't think they would care, unfortunately. But, and they were allowed to, but Jesus, putting him on a cross was a different thing because that was a Roman form of execution, so stoning was the Jewish form. But so that's my thought, though. I think it's a conspiracy to set Jesus up. They let the guy go because he was part of it. And then they caught her, and then they could, you know, put Jesus in this bind where he had to approve the stoning of this woman, which would have been, I guess, considered some kind of... You put him in the middle, you know. Are you really this gracious Savior that's come to the world, or what? I see some of the problems that, besides the manuscript evidence, which is overwhelming, apparently, I see some of the problems of putting this here, unless you go back up to... what Nicodemus said in verse 51, you know, does our Lord judge a man without first giving a hearing and hearing what he does? And then, so I don't know if that's, you know, if that's why they stuck it here. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was kind of doing the same thing about what is the test? Because their questions are often, well, if he says one thing, he's going to lose these people, or yeah, he's going to be, you know, wrong over here. Or if he says the other thing, he's going to be wrong over here. And it, I'm trying to figure out what the angle is if he says, yeah, go ahead and stone her. Like, what is the impact of that? And I guess it would be because his message has been somewhat confrontational with the law and with the excessive, you know, interpretation of that law. And, with, you know, he's talking about grace and mercy. And I guess that would be the test of that. Because if he says, no, you don't stone her, that wouldn't be right, then I can see where that is going to put him at odds with some in the way that they've been challenging him all along, which is, you don't follow the law. So they're saying, this is the law, are you going to follow this law? And he's been questioning whether or not the law is being interpreted correctly and applied correctly from this group of people. So I could see where that part of it was a test. But his answer does... He's figured out there's some bracketing here. There's some, well, if I say this, you know,
right,
that's a problem, and if I say this, that's a problem. So his answer is the unique answer that Jesus is always seems to be able to give that takes it to another level and makes everyone kind of apply something.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And that's what makes this kind of a favorite story. I mean, you know, though it probably doesn't belong here, at least here. It is a favorite story because of that, I think, because he comes up like he does when they say, "Do we pay taxes?" You know, and he shows you, "Give me the coin," and he says, "Render to God what's God and Caesar what's Caesar's." It kind of like puts them in the bind. Oh, okay, they go away scratching their head. Now what are we going to do? And in this case, they all kind of they knew, they were convicted that they were complicit in, I think. And so, yeah, I mean, that I think that's, they wanted to put him on one side or another, as you said. They wanted to fix Jesus in some camp. They wanted to put him in some camp. They wanted to label him somehow. He refused to be labeled. And this is a good illustration of that. This is a good illustration of how he didn't allow them to do that. If they're going to label him, they're going to have to label him as God on earth, and they weren't willing to do that.
He labeled him teacher, though. They said teacher.
Teacher, you know? Yeah.
So they knew that he had some authority, some knowledge, some, you know, something that he would have to offer. They were, I agree, they were questioning his authority as a teacher.
Yeah, and that is consistent with what they've been doing all along in John up to this point. That's right. Consistently questioning his authority. So this was another way of doing that.
And that teacher piece is interesting because he's been teaching. I go back to that Sermon on the Mount mentality that he said, "You've heard it said this, and it's all being interpreted this way, but I'm here to teach something different that takes that to another level and really gets at the heart and the relationships and all of the other pieces." And this seems to be a very similar way in which he's approaching this dilemma. Yeah. The teacher part of it.
Yeah.
And we get a great insight into the character of God because he's demonstrating mercy.
Mm-hmm.
And yet earlier he said, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall be shown mercy."
Mm-hmm.
And he echoes the words of the prophet Micah. "He has shown you, O man, what is good, but what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to demonstrate mercy, to walk humbly with your God."
Right. Yes. And that's why the account itself, wherever it belongs, is popular. Because it does fit the character of Jesus clearly. None of us be surprised if this really happened. You know, none of us would say it's inconsistent with what Jesus has done all along and what he's taught and how he's acted. And so that's why it's in brackets. If it was really, given the manuscript evidence or lack thereof, you might expect it just to be locked out of here. We have the same problem at the end of Mark, you know, from Mark 8 to 16, or 8 to 20. Same issue comes up, but we're not studying Mark right now. So. okay, let's move on. Jesus in verse 12, no question about the rest of this as far as the manuscript stuff goes. he says, and I just want to focus on this for a minute without getting into the... I think we know the context if you've read John prior to coming here, this section. But verse 12 says, "Again, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." And then the Pharisees break off and say, "You're talking about yourself. What are you talking about yourself for?" They completely ignore his point. But let's not ignore his point. What is he saying here? The question I have is, what did he mean when he said, "I am the light of the world"? And then I said, think about some of these other passages. But... I think somebody reading this for the very first time can come up with some answers, right?
It's interesting, just from a straight practical analogy, when you're in the dark, there is no substitute for light. It's not like with other things, I can use a wrench for a hammer or something.
Yeah, right.
You have to have light. You're always looking for some kind of source.
It has to be some light.
It has to be light. There's no other substitute, or you're just overcome with the darkness.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Very good. Very basic, right? And light serves a purpose that we all appreciate. Those of us, at least a few of us in this room, have had to deal with power outages lately. Good old California power outages. And PG&E. And, okay, I'll admit to being extremely frustrated, especially on the first one. Because I just didn't believe they would turn our lights off. I mean, I was like denying all the emails and texts I was getting and everything else. They just wouldn't. We live in this tract. There's no fire danger here. There's nothing can happen here. And I'm just like rebelling against the authority they have to turn our lights off. And then all of a sudden, you know, midnight. I wake up at 12:34. We find out it is. Wake up and, you know, kind of as you wake up and you go, wow, it's really dark in here. You know, it was darker than usual, even though it's nighttime, we got the lights off.
So I guess we could say, you do not love the darkness.
Yes, I like that. You know, darkness. Man, it's good to know. You're good to know, yeah. So yeah, I mean, I appreciate light a little more now than I did a few months ago, I guess, because it's something you really get used to it. You get used to flipping a switch. Magic. I have no idea how to explain how that happened. I could never explain that. I'm sure people in this room could.
Well, as you've got the scriptures down here in chapter 3, he's already told them. He says the light is coming in the world, but they love darkness. And he says the light that shines on them and it shows their works are evil. And so he's already told them that. So that's what you referenced there about on that.
Yeah, and then chapter 3, yeah.
Yeah, it's already come up.
It's already, and back in chapter 1, right? I've got that on there too. Verse 4. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness is not overcome it. There was a man sent from God, his name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, that gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. So, clearly... So let's go back with those passages. We know what light does, as we've talked about here. I mean, just in a very real, practical sense, and also in the sense that Jesus is bearing witness to their evil simply by being who he is and teaching what he teaches, which is pure teaching from God. But look at what do you think their reaction? Because he didn't just say, I'm the light. He says, I'm the light of the world. You didn't say I'm light in a room, you know. Say I'm light in a cave. I mean, you use all that now. He's I'm the light of the world. So expand that a little bit. What is that? Where's that going?
I'm still trying to catch up with you a little bit before I would be willing to expand on that. But that statement, I think, is one of the very important statements just because of the vocabulary that's used in this text. Mm-hmm. Light, darkness, judgment, or judge, father, witness, die, mm-hmm. sin. So just the vocabulary that's used tells me that it's something very serious, that there's no gray, it's light or dark. And if I don't get it figured out, there's death. I don't want to be a part of sin or death.
Right.
So there's, once again, I'm the light of the world. He's not leaving another option. It's light or dark.
Right.
And so what would prevent me from seeing the light?
Yeah.
That would be my question for myself.
Yes, right. Yeah, good application question. We'll come back to it. But I am the light of the world. Janet?
I think another important part that we haven't touched on about him being the light of the world goes back to the first chapter of John, where it says, no one has seen God at any time. But... that Jesus declares him. A huge part of how we understand God is through knowing Jesus. And without Jesus shedding this huge light on God, what a difficult, terrible world we would have. I can't imagine not knowing God from what Jesus has told us about him.
Right.
So I think that's a huge... It's not just him shedding light on our sin, but him showing us God.
Yeah, right. He's enlightened man. And as in chapter 14 points out when he's talking to Philip and says, show us the Father and be enough for us. He says, you see me, you see the Father. He's enlightened the world about God. And then Hebrews makes a big deal about that too. In Hebrews chapter 1 says he's the exact imprint of his nature. So that's part of, clearly a huge part of what he does. And I think it's very important, as you say, because we look at Jesus and what he did, now we're seeing God. Sometimes we get wrapped up in the Old Testament, a lot of things God did there, and there's some really hard questions that come out of that. But what we're seeing in the New Covenant, New Testament, we see Jesus, we're seeing God in action. In real life, and that's important. That's what I focus on, by the way. I don't focus on all this stuff.
Well, the other thing he's saying is, or at least what they would be thinking is, he's taking our position.
Yeah.
He is claiming to be what we, the Pharisees, are we're claiming to be. That, I mean, they think that they are the truth in the world, that they have the law, they have the oracles of God. They are the only way to God. And by him saying, I'm the light of the world, it's saying, you're done. What you're saying is wrong. And that's, I think that's why they immediately respond that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, look, and then they talk about the testimony, right? That's very important to them. They're like, well, look, we've got thousands of years of testimony that we are the chosen ones. How can you be the chosen one? That's not how this whole thing works.
No, right. He says, I'm the light of the world. He's saying nobody else is, including you Pharisees, you Sadducees, you Caiaphas, you all of those you people who thought they were the light of the world. Also saying it to Caesar, which that turns up the heat quite a bit as we move through it. But let's read the rest of this, because I'm getting a little comfortable not being in the context here. Then we'll come back. Got a couple of comments there. Let's read from 12 to, that's all the way down to 30. Somebody want to read that much? Jack, read that much.
Again, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have light in of life. So the Pharisees said to him, you are bearing witness about yourself. Your testimony is not true. Jesus answered, even if I do bear witness about myself, my testimony is true. For I know where I came from and where I am going, but you do not know where I have come from or where I am going. You judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. Yet even if I do judge, my judgment is true, for it is not I alone who judge, but I and the Father who sent me. In your law it is written that the testimony of two people is true. I am the one who bears witness about myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness about me. They said to him, therefore, where is your Father? Jesus answered, you know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. These words he spoke in the treasury, as he taught in the temple, but no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. So he said again to them, I am going away, and you will seek me, and you will die in your sin. Where I am going, you cannot come. So the Jews said, will he kill himself, since he says, where I am going, you cannot come? He said to them, you are from below, I am from above. You are of this world, I am not of this world. I told you that you would die in your sins, for unless you believe that I am he, you will die in your sins. So they said to him, who are you? Jesus said to them, just what I have been telling you from the beginning. I have much to say about you and much to judge, but he who sent me is true, and I declare to the world what I have heard from him. They did not understand that he had been speaking to them about the Father. So Jesus said to them, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am he, and that I do nothing on my own authority, but speak just as the Father taught me. And he who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone, for I always do the things that are pleasing to him. And as he was saying these things, many believed in him.
Okay, before we take your comments, a couple of comments that are hanging out there. Ken, if you're totally wrapped up in this world, if your thinking is totally worldly and materialistic, would you have any idea what Jesus is talking about here? You really got to have a spiritual attitude or some spiritual sense to get it at all. And you can just see, because these people are... He mentions this, I think, in verse 23. You're from below. In other words, what term is he used before? He said, you're in the flesh. That's where you sit. You sit in the flesh. You sit in this world. I'm from above. I'm from the Spirit. And he's talking to them. I think he's raising the stakes here in some of this. I don't think... It's not plain. It's not really plain. I mean, he kind of goes back and forth and brings up different things that he knows you're not going to agree with. And so, I'm not plain to them, is what I mean to say. And he convicts them. It's going to get worse. It's going to get more specific in verse 44 when he says, you were your father, the devil. So you can say you're going to pull any punches that he stops pulling. If there's any punches he's pulled so far, he's going to stop there, right? You have your father, the devil. And he's a liar. He's a liar from the beginning. He always has been a liar. In other words, you're liars. That's what he says. That's what Jesus, meek and mild, says to these people. But let's just deal with this. And I don't know, you know, Jeff, I know you had a comment, and it may not have anything to do with what we just talked about.
It actually probably had more to do with the text we just read than
okay, good.
We
good.
Were on before. But I was just thinking about in 1 John, John, same writer there, says that God is light, mm-hmm. and in him there is no darkness. And so I was thinking about Bennett's comment because I was thinking along the same lines. In the absence of God, in the absence of Jesus coming to the world, the world would be completely and utterly dark. It would be enveloped in darkness because God and Jesus are the very source of light.
Right.
So that there's a statement about the quality and the character of Jesus, and then there's a statement which we talked a little bit about what that light does. You know, I was thinking about Thomas's comment too about how the Jews or the Pharisees, I think one of the same when John's talking about the Jews, would say that, yeah, we agree, God is light, and we know God. And Jesus here is saying, no, you don't, because if you knew me, you would know God, and you would know that I'm here to illuminate the path to a relationship with God. You can't have a relationship with God except through me. And, you know, it's clear that they weren't getting that. And in doing so, not only is he showing them the path to God by illuminating that path through his teaching, through his character, he's also, that light is also illuminating their sin. And you know, we know that sinners don't like the light because it exposes their deeds, and that's what he's doing here as well. He's exposing their hypocrisy and their wickedness and their selfishness and their lack of knowledge and understanding about the law and the scriptures, which all pointed to his coming, and yet they refused to see it.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's a good summary of all that. That's right. Somebody else had a hand. I don't miss anybody. Thomas, go ahead. I thought there's somebody over here.
Well, it's interesting that verse 13, mm-hmm. they're using, I don't know if this is the same people that were in the room or present when Jesus spoke in chapter 5, but if you go back to chapter 5, verse 31, he says, if I alone testify about myself, my testimony is not true. So I wonder if some of these Jews are the same ones that were there when they heard that, which I think at this point in time, chronologically, was like a year ago, at least.
Was it that far back?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't think. I don't think we have another Passover yet. So.
Oh, okay. So it's not that long ago then.
Yeah.
And then they use that exact same phrase against him, right? Uh-huh. You are testifying about yourself. Your testimony is not true. So at least they heard that from him previously, but they missed the whole rest of it. That his miracles, the works he was doing, were that confirming testimony that God sent him. It's like they just wanted to completely ignore that. And he doesn't bring up, which I think is interesting, this is like a more truncated version here in chapter 8 than what all his defenses he was giving in chapter 5.
Chapter 5, yeah.
So it's a more truncated version. Probably he got tired of, maybe he did say a lot of the same things again, or maybe he just got tired of reiterating that because they clearly didn't see it, because every time he performed a sign, they would ask for another one right away.
Fine.
So they weren't making that connection. But it is. I just found that very interesting that they're literally using his exact phrase against him now. But just clearly shows their lack of understanding.
Yeah, and this whole thing, reading all this time too, really brings new meaning to not connecting the dots for me. And they're, you know, when you think about that, and you think about the Jews and their response to him, they completely are, they're every way. They're just finding ways to try to discredit Jesus. Brady?
I'm glad Thomas brought out the witness part of it. Because I find another little part interesting about this section, too, with regards to needing two witnesses there.
Uh-huh.
And the thing that I find interesting about that is that I'm pretty sure it's kind of harkening back to that part in Deuteronomy that says that you need two witnesses to condemn a man to death. And the other part of that is the people that condemn the person to death are the ones that are the first to throw the stone. So if you go, you know, again, I don't know about if whether or not this needs to be in this manuscript or not, the first part of 8, but that is the part of the law that he reckons back to when he says, okay, if this woman was in adultery, then you who are without sin, you need to be the ones to cast the first stone. That's part of that law.
Yeah.
And then they reference that part about the two witnesses. That same law, they reference it again in verse 12. I just think that's very interesting.
Yeah.
So whether or not that first part of 8 about the adulterous woman is supposed to be in there, I would argue that if it is supposed to be somewhere, maybe that is a good place to have it. So maybe they're talking about the same law there, and that's what's hearkening or what's making them come back to that law.
Yeah. I mean, it could well be that that's why they put it there.
Not at all.
Of course not. We don't know, do we? But that's very, very possible. But that's why they plugged it in here. Allison.
In verse 27, it says, they did not understand that he had been speaking to them about the Father. And at first, well, I still don't know that I understand how they didn't understand, because he says the words Father like 1,000 times. So, but then I did try to put myself in their position, and I don't know if this is a thing or not. But, I mean, it doesn't say, like, they pretended not to understand. It does say they didn't understand that he was talking about the Father, even though he keeps saying the Father. But we're looking at it in writing. They would have been hearing it, and it's not like he's saying, even if you don't judge, verse 16, my judgment is true, for it is not I alone who judge, but I am the capital F Father who sent me. He's not saying that. So is it possible that they're like, because then they're like, where's your Father? Is it possible that's the part they're not getting, is that he's not talking about his earthly Father, but he's talking about God? Because he doesn't say God. He just says Father all throughout that section.
Right. Two things. I think, number one, I immediately think of verse 43, but that could be a different group. But why do you not understand what I say? Is because you cannot bear to hear my word. So that could be a possible answer to that. The other thing is that we said earlier, if you're not thinking spiritually, if you kind of missed everything you said up to this time, kind of going back to Thomas's point about chapter 5, you know, all those witnesses and all that he was very, very clear on. I think we can all see he's calling, it's like calling witnesses to the stand. We heard them. And one's the Father, of course. And then all the times he said Father before this. We don't get the idea that this is a completely different set of people, although he's speaking, it says, in the treasury, which is interesting. But so I don't know. It could be they're just not getting it. As I said earlier, that we do know, and we're kind of in the thing. I don't know who had their hand up first, because I'm all at once. We need buzzers in here. Numbers. Go ahead.
Well, I wrote down two things, and very much like what Alice, I wrote down, one, they didn't want to understand. And two, that was just my, and I write down things as they come, thoughts to my mind. And the second question I wrote, if not the Father, capital F Father, then who
do you think?
Who were they? I can't figure out who they were. I mean, they couldn't either, I guess. I guess that's the thing, but if not God the Father, where they never said, oh, are you talking about Joseph? I mean, you know, like,
no.
I don't know. I just feel like it's a density by choice.
Yeah, and verse...
Maybe Abraham?
Maybe Abraham, right? He comes up here eventually. Abraham is, in verse 39, Abraham is our father. And so that could be. There are lots of possibilities, Tim. And then,
well, I was just going to say, and this is just a little bit of my own kind of thoughts on it. I know from all the years of doing theater, one thing that they always told us is that very rarely does the bad guy actually think of himself as bad, right? Like, they have their reasons and justifications, sure, and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, I think if I put, like, myself kind of in their shoes, you know, I've been, quote-unquote, raised on the pew, and I have my beliefs and everything, and all of a sudden somebody walks in and is saying stuff that, like you're saying, I mean, he's starting to just not pull punches and telling me how evil I am and all this kind of stuff, that, yeah, if he did some sort of miracle or what I might think is, like, what, how much would it take for me to really stop and be able to think, like, clearly enough to even give this, you know, much of a good thought about, you know, what is he saying? Is what he's saying is true? And I just keep thinking that from, like, my, I'm like, what would it take for me to get to that point, to really just full stop and re-examine
basically my entire existence up until that point. Sometimes I think we, again, because we have the written word in front of us and it's easy and when we can piece this and that and it was said this year far after and this much before, I do think it is just interesting that they're in that moment. I mean, again, not to excuse them, not to say that they have any good sound reason for it, but just, again, they're humans in that moment and they are up against this full stop, completely different direction. And so I could see how their gears are just clinking back and forth, trying to, what are you talking about? I don't get it. This can't be true. I don't know if that makes...
No, that makes sense. I will remind us all that, and you can come over to our house sometime this week, and we'll all listen to the whole gospel read straight through. Because then I think what happens when, you know, of necessity in these, when we study these chunks, we forget all the, kind of forget what's gone before and how often he said this, and Allison alluded to it, but how often he said this. And I mean, he's moving around in this relatively small town space in Jerusalem and saying these things in different places, but this, it's the same group pretty much to hear him. And so I do think we lose something in that they have no, it's not like this is the first time they've heard this, and you know, and John, remember John's been preaching for a while? We don't even have much record of that in the book of John, but I'm talking about John the Baptist. He comes along, he's preaching for a while. And so I just would throw that reminder out there. It's good to say, maybe listen to the thing all at once. We listen to, I just throw in this, we listen to the book of Mark performed verbatim. Everything came verbatim from the ESV version by what's his name? Max McLean, the fellow who read the ESV version on the audio version when it first came out. And he's also a very, very good actor. We saw him play C.S. Lewis out at Harris Center on The Most Reluctant Convert, which I highly recommend too. But hearing that way was a different experience. You know, when you hear it all together and actually dramatized, not overly done. I think he did a great job. We thought he did a really nice job. And it does, that does kind of help to give the sense.
Yeah, well, and just follow up. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that they didn't have ample opportunity or enough evidence to believe it.
Yeah. So that was my point. I'm just saying that we do. I mean, I do too, because we're reading it, this little chunk here. It sounds really kind of confusing, and we could kind of. And I do think it's always a good idea to put yourself in the place of the. It's much more healthy to put yourself in the place of the person who's not getting it than it is to. Basically, in my opinion, because then you're going to double check yourself, right? So. Christy, and then...
Well, Tim said he wasn't sure if he would have listened if somebody came and told him, having been raised on the pew, but these people had listened to the Old Testament, had the word of Isaiah,
right.
They had all of this, and they were always looking for the Messiah. That was their job. That's what they were looking for. And so for them to miss it, was big. And when
indictable.
He says certain things, they should have gone, oh, that connects up to what Abraham said, what Moses said, what Isaiah said. And they didn't get it because they chose, Angie said they chose not to. I think if Tim had been hearing something saying, Tim, listen for this, listen for this, listen for this, watch for this, and when it happened, he would have got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think we need to understand.
Maybe we're giving too much credit. I don't know. We can ask Karen. But
thank you, Christy.
He was getting really nervous there for a while. Would I get it? Would I get it?
No.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I've got Isaiah 9:1-7 here that's really explicit, and there's many other, of course, prophecy. Amy.
Yeah, I agree with Christy, and I think that there's evidence for that in verse 30. In the text, as he was saying these things, many believed in him. And
right.
I think the fact that maybe his primary audience, the people he's trying to persuade, are the ones who are the most resistant. And I think they're resistant because power is at stake. They have something to lose.
Right.
So they are electing not to believe, as Christy points out, that they're willfully ignorant and mishearing because the skin that they have in the game is... like, it's power-based and it's personal. And there are honest listeners who he's reaching here. And that proves that his statements aren't inscrutable. That, like, oh, no one could understand this, so no wonder. Like, no, people are understanding and they're believing and they are persuaded. And the people who aren't are those who have
different priorities and a different agenda.
Yeah, the only thing I would... That was a great comment. The only thing I would say is I wonder who his primary audience really was. You know, when you're talking to somebody who you know, he had to know they're not gonna fold over for what he says. He's not gonna give in to what he says. It's you know that overhearing thing we talk about so much. You know, I've used that before.
When you discipline one kid,
yeah,
hoping
the others hear. You expect them to gather information from that, and so his primary audience may have been. His directed, you know, what he's targeting and directing is one thing. What he wants these people to hear, so they're going to sit back and they're going to, you know, you've heard this before. You see opposition to something that seems so odd, and you say, why are they opposing this? What is going on? What is their agenda? You say that yourself, and you learn from that when people respond a certain way. So I think that's it, Aaron. But you had your kind of.
Well, no, that's okay. All right. Yeah,
Aaron, go down and then.
I think that's really important point that you just made was that I think the fact that he was gearing his, I'm going to say attacks, but, you know, gearing his points directly at the Pharisees, knowing that he wasn't really going to change their minds, but that other people were listening. I think he did that really, I mean, I've said this before, but he's not doing anything by accident.
No.
That had a purpose. And I know, you know, later on, when we get into the epistles, we know that there are some who were converted who then later are like, kind of wanting to go back. And I think it's important for them to have been able to say, okay, Jesus didn't just come and teach us about stuff. He actually straight out condemned the Pharisees.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, that to them, if someone came and taught you something, and then later on you're like thinking about going back, it would have maybe meant more or had more of an impact if you knew that the person who taught you directly said, those people don't know what they're doing. Don't know what they're doing instead of just having taught you. So I think that serves kind of a dual purpose there.
Yeah, yeah, agree.
Well, some are defensive because this is the first time that he has challenged them and he's addressed their religious traditions.
Right.
So they're having a hard time hearing maybe because their pride has been attacked.
Yes.
And so now they're in retaliation.
Right. That was.